Hi, everyone. This is Dean Haglund from the offices of Rational Exuberance North, home of the greenery in the middle of a heat wave here in downtown.
Home of the editing.
Of the editing.
The feature-length documentary, The Truth Is Out There.
That's right. Our post-production house.
Until last week, home of the two feature-length documentaries called The Truth Is Out There.
Now cut to one.
We've got it down almost to one.
Look at that.
I'm Phil Larinus.
You are Phil Larinus. And you're listening to your Chilpec Hollywood Hour.
Indeed they are. You know, when we started this show, of course.
Many, many years ago.
More than 3 years ago.
I remember it not well.
We were in offices next door to each other.
Yes.
Over in Carthay Circle.
It was.
Yeah, Carthay Circle.
And the site that was the glorious theater where they premiered the great Disney animated feature.
Was it Fantasia?
No, Snow White.
Snow White.
Snow White.
And of course, in these twin, I'm not going to call them towers,
no,
because they're only like five stories tall, but twin buildings.
Buildings, 70s designed.
And in the same suite number in our opposite building, you know, in our mirror image, our alternate universe building.
Right.
And it really was kind of that. The same suite number in the other building. And these buildings didn't actually have, I don't think, clearly marked addresses distinguishing the two.
No, it was just a big number somewhere, but I didn't see it.
And so it seemed like they were all part of the same address. But in our opposite number was the casting, famous casting director's office. But among other things, they did the casting, of course, for Entourage. So we always knew when Entourage was in production.
Because we'd have actresses walk in.
Because once a day during that time of year, we'd have somebody dressed like a hooker coming into the... Because, and I don't mean it pejoratively.
Right?
I'm not saying that actresses dress like hookers. What I'm saying is that's generally the roles that are being cast.
The roles that are cast on Entourage. And that's why I started watching it. Huzzah!
Oh, it all worked out. All worked out well. Anyway, I bring up those salad days, because our halcyon days, because back then, long before producing this documentary and the offices of Rational Exuberance, you know, we would introduce and explain who we were.
Right.
You're TV's Dean Haglund.
I was TV's.
You were Canada's Dean Haglund.
I still technically am.
Something might be changing.
Well, exactly. I got my letter in the mail November 1st.
What happens on November 1st?
I go in for my interview, and they ask me questions about being an American, which I will then get my U.S. citizenship.
Oh.
Wow.
Now, you're not going to get confused and think that this is like a podcast interview or a webcast interview or something like that.
I
right?
totally will. Hey, thanks for asking that, mister. You know, funny story to go with
I
that.
I think your audience will love to hear this.
Here's the funny thing about American history. There's 13 stripes, not only for the 13 founding colonies, but it's also a way to balance out the colors of the flag. What? No, that's not it.
I actually waited for some funny.
No, there was no funny.
The funny's
gone.
So
that,
you are,
I'm
in
sleepy.
Fact, ready to become an American. Now, of course, you know, we would identify me as an independent filmmaker, managing director of cinema arts and artities. And also, of course, something we haven't talked about in a while, but the...
Raconteur?
Well, I'm still a raconteur, but certified violence prevention specialist.
That's right.
I did do and still do, to the degree that our post-production schedule allows, work with you know, education programs and, of course, survivors of sexual assault, abuse, molestation. And in that capacity, it has been a while since I've actually brought anything up on the show,
right.
And something was sent to me that I wanted to pass along.
Oh, is this
to our listeners?
Email already?
And it feels perfect again, also for this forum, because, you know, it is the Chilpec Hollywood Hour. It's their Chilpec Hollywood Hour.
Everyone's.
And
Chilpec
sometimes Hollywood gets it right, and sometimes.
Wow.
In the stories that we tell, we actually include
positive
information and storylines that directly relate to what many people in this country are facing and feeling. Imagine us as Hollywood storytellers not just gazing at our own navels.
Are you talking about Waiting for Superman, the documentary that may change American public school systems?
Well, I am looking forward to that.
Yeah.
What I'm also looking forward to, though, is this week's episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit.
I beg your pardon?
Because the producers and writers of Law and Order Special Victims Unit have been working with the Joyful Heart Foundation to craft a storyline that calls attention to the disastrous backlog in rape the rape kit testing.
This has the DNA evidence. There's like a box that has everything involved in the case.
As soon as rape has been reported or suspected or evidence is taken. Exactly. And forensics evidence.
And then they just put it on a shelf and wait for a lab to pick it up? How does this work on the LAPD? Because I read about this and I don't have any idea of it sounds like there's a big warehouse of all these little boxes that has a name on it and a year. Well, and then there's a cotton swab in there, and they're waiting for somebody to do something.
Abby Sims, who was my mentor, I guess you could say, when I was starting in the violence prevention movement and trained me. And she was, at that time, head of education for the Los Angeles Commission on Assaults Against Women, and now is one of the directors of Joyful Heart Foundation. And she's based here in L.A. And she wrote that the episode was inspired by the story of a dear friend who waited 13 years for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department to test the rape kit that was collected in the days immediately following her 17th birthday. So this is evidence that sat untested for 13 years, and this...
Is it still good? I mean, can it still produce results?
Well, I think so. I mean, when you think about the DNA tests that are done to exonerate people from 20 years ago or more,
that stays.
I would think that, of course, it would be. And to a degree, I mean, the question always becomes, you know, how are these kits handled?
Right.
If they are preserved and simply, you know, there's just the backlog, but there's nothing, you know, going on to damage them in any way, I wouldn't see why they wouldn't be good. But anyway, but it's an interesting topic, and I think it's one that people aren't aware of. I mean, we have talked about on the show before, you know, just the alarming and, I mean, the epidemic numbers of people who are survivors of sexual assault and sexual violence.
But it's also a good time for LAPD to get on this because it's our lowest homicide rate since the history of bookkeeping.
That's the thing is, you know, you watch the news, you know, at any time, and you always think, you know, it's very easy to get the impression that the country and our cities and everything is getting more and more violent all the time.
Right.
You know, it's very easy to get that impression.
Sure.
And if you look at the trends over the last quarter century, and even violence has gone down. It's become a less violent culture in that sense. The numbers that continue to rise are sexual violence and partner violence, domestic violence, abuse of children.
So the correlation is that
correlation between
the drop in homicide rates and the rise in the.
Well, I think to a degree, probably it's.
Is there statistical?
I would think a lot of it would have to do with enforcement. A lot of it would have to do with, you know, so many different things. But really, fundamentally, one of the beliefs of the violence prevention movement is, of course, that it's not about preventing violence in relationships of all manner as an end point. It's about promoting healthy relationships.
Right.
That there will always be work to be done because relationships can always be more healthy.
Right.
But really, in looking at it, there's just an incredible amount of education that needs to be done because that area wasn't looked at for
a long time.
For a long, long time. So this is another story that it seems to me can really shine a light on.
Did Law and Order approach the Joyful?
Well,
or the
Mariska
other way?
Hargitay is the star of Law and Order Special Victims Unit, right? And she's. I've never met her. I hear wonderful things, and I do know for a fact that she's incredibly involved in violence prevention movement, in survivor recovery programs. And so I imagine that she's very much the linchpin behind wanting this to be a part of the show.
Right.
So I don't want to, go off too, but that's this week on Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
I'm going to watch it.
And there is a watching party, a virtual watching party that's advertised on Facebook because these numbers are really important.
Uh-huh.
And so on our Chilpak Hollywood page on Facebook, that's facebook.com/ChilpakHollywood, I'll post a thing about it in a link, and hopefully many of our likers will go there and say, I am attending the viewing of Law & Order Special Victims Unit this week.
And so all I have to do is watch it. I don't have to go to a party or some facility.
No. It's literally just a way for them to keep track of numbers that is outside the Nielsen that says this is how many people are watching this episode because this storyline matters to them.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. My fan's going. Can I go while you're talking?
Well,
I'll get a chill pack.
Yeah, why don't you get us both?
There's
tell two chill packs in the freezer, and I'll set the next topic.
Okay, and tell them what I'm getting too while you're at it.
Oh well, what you're getting, I don't know. Maybe I should hold the microphone up to your computer. Can you hear that? Can you hear that? It's a loud fan sound on his laptop. Because the computer's heating up. I mean, it's going to be 110 here in Los Angeles today.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And really, the whole town needs a chill pack.
Yes.
Not least of which, though, is our laptop computers. And, within moments, his computer is going to be running silently.
Right.
Because he's now put a chill pack underneath it. And the chill pack, of course, takes your laptop computer and keeps it running fast and increases its longevity by keeping it cool. It's a easy-to-use, environmentally friendly gel pack that you just slide right under your laptop computer, draws heat away from the CPU. Check it out at chillpack.com, chillpak.com.
So sweet.
Now, this combination of storytelling and I guess political activism, we could call it.
Progressive change, positive forces in the society.
Brings to mind, Stephen, already your laptop is silent. It's silent.
Yeah, the motor's, that's it. The fan just shut down.
That's amazing.
Well, how fast was that? Look it on your timer, everyone.
Stephen Colbert went to Washington.
Wasn't that awesome? Did you see it?
He spoke before a congressional panel.
Yep.
Talking about
good for him.
Immigration, farmers, farmers' rights, but I mean it's all about, to set this topic for anybody who hasn't seen it or people outside the country. America's got a lot of agriculture. All the jobs are done by illegal immigrants because this is my opinion. I'm not alone in this because no Americans would want the jobs in the first place.
That's right. In fact, did you know how this whole started? Do you watch the Colbert Report?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where is
a representative from California.
From Take Our Jobs, which is the movement for all the unemployed Americans to go out into the fields and take the jobs that these immigrant laborers do.
Are supposedly stealing from us.
Yeah. Yeah. And do that because there's these jobs waiting for you. And so
because
Colbert,
we run this double-edged thing, which is we say, "Don't, it's illegal, don't come here.
Right.
Here, please take this job."
Yeah, because it's really hard. Yeah. And so 16 people actually applied out of
thousands
42
of jobs?
Million, 42 million people unemployed, and 16 of them took that.
And how many people were they looking for? I mean, there were literally tens of thousands
tens
of jobs.
Tens of thousands of jobs, yeah. And these are the same jobs, like from Grapes of Wrath.
Right.
Where all of
migrant
those guys,
field workers.
Migrant field workers. And so Stephen Colbert did that for all of 10 hours.
Yeah, one day.
one day. And then went to Congress to report on that.
Yeah, and she invited him to speak.
Yeah.
Now, Congress is really kind of outraged about his appearance, that he was asked to leave while speaking on a couple of occasions. There's some really funny bits, really funny lines, and also some wonderfully touching moment when he talks about why he is there.
Right.
And why he enjoys using his celebrity for certain causes. So you can check out all the videos. I mean, they're on YouTube. All over the web. So you found it hilarious, and you said good for him.
Yeah, I did say good for him.
And why was your attitude good
for
him?
Well, he pointed out the hypocrisy of the whole Congress, how they don't get together. His final statement, he says, I'm sure everybody here at the thing will work together regardless of their party for doing what's the best for America, because that's what you do. And that shut them up more than anything else, because that's not what they do. We have a Congress so divided, so political lines, that regardless of whether it's good for America or not, they don't bother. They'll just vote just to screw the other guy and not really be concerned of how it'll affect the future of the country.
One thing that I am somewhat pleased by in my in viewing all this and in viewing reaction to Stephen Colbert himself of late is I feel a return to one thing that I liked a bit when I was coming of age, which is the Democrats really seem to hate Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
You know, and he pretends, again, we have many people who listen outside this country who don't know Stephen Colbert. He has a late night comedy show, The Colbert Report, and he pretends to be a right wing, a conservative pundit.
Right.
Like Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck, people that we have here on the Fox News channel. And he pretends to be.
Right. But he does it so well that he actually was invited to give the keynote address to the President Bush's
White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Because the Republican Party thought he really was conservative. They didn't realize.
Right. They knew he was a comedian, but they thought he was conservative. But here's the thing that's interesting is Democrats, I guess, I don't want to say for sure that it's Nancy Pelosi, but some high-ranking Democrat, it might have been her. It might have been the Democratic National Chair, but issued basically a directive that Democrats shouldn't go on the Colbert Report.
Oh, is that right?
And, you know, it's so funny. And yet Republicans will go on. And you know, the joke is out. People know that he's not. And it's, I just would like to say that when I was growing up, if you wanted to find a politician with a sense of humor, odds were that person was a conservative.
Right.
And I feel like to a degree we're getting back to that almost.
Yeah, that full circle.
There's a lot of thin-skinned Democrats.
Yeah, so it would seem. Yeah. But rightly so. I mean, they are on the ropes, as it were, because I don't understand. I mean, to me, these labels are completely innocuous, and I would rather vote independent.
But what is that? You know, and I guess that's the attraction of the Tea Party movement.
Also somebody who's thinking and doesn't have to follow a party line.
Right, a party line.
Because, you know, the Republicans now aren't the Eisenhower Republicans, and the Democrats aren't the old.
But I want to, so again, good for you for Stephen Colbert. Now, let me ask you this. And I love that you said good for you. I mean, who has more balls as a comedian? I mean, seriously, than Stephen Colbert?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And just to walk in like that.
And he pushes things and he shows no fear and he really does go after it. And I actually found myself, and I'm a huge fan, and I've always been a huge fan of Stephen Colbert. I was a huge fan of Stephen Colbert, of course, from The Daily Show and Strangers with Candy. Oh, yeah. And I find myself uncomfortable with it. And I find myself uncomfortable with it because...
it's not the forum for comedy?
Well, no, not that it's not the forum for comedy. It just, was it disrespectful?
Was it disrespectful? Well, any more disrespectful than somebody voting against a bill because it came up from a Democratic thought, and that even though it will give veterans more... benefits. I'm thinking of that one bill that veterans were going to get discounts for medical services, and it was voted down because it came up. It was introduced by Al Franken.
Yeah.
And everybody hates that guy, apparently. And so his bill, Al Franken's other bill about sexual violence. Remember that one came up, his first bill in office, and everybody voted that down.
Well, there's two issues here for me. One is, you know, I try to hew as close as possible to the belief. Look, does Congress disrespect the people?
Yes.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. Has the office of the president disrespected the people? Is disrespect becoming an ever bigger part of
daily discourse
on Washington by our supposed leadership?
Yeah.
Right? And isn't that a big problem? I mean, if these are leaders, do we expect them to always get it right? We shouldn't, because that's unfair.
Right. Human nature.
Do we expect them to always agree? Of course not, nor should we want that. Disagreement and diverse opinions can lead to something better. That would be the idea, right? So we don't expect those things. However, what should we expect of our leaders? Well, I would think leadership. And one of the things that you want from people in leadership is for them to embody certain things like respect.
Exactly.
Like respect. If we want to live in a respectful culture, and I'm not putting all the blame on them and taking the blame away from us. In fact, look, clearly I feel our supposed leaders have failed in almost every criterion of leadership you can possibly imagine.
Absolutely.
Therefore, I think the responsibility does fall to the people.
Right.
That if these individuals are disrespecting us, disrespecting the country, disrespecting the Constitution, disrespecting the office, disrespecting the institutions, whatever you want to say, maybe it is incumbent upon us to show greater respect.
Okay, then that just allows us to be doormats. Then they go, oh, well.
Well, it really becomes tricky. No, it really does. I mean, that does not mean respect, again, does not mean agreement or going along or any, you know, of these things. That's always the real struggle, is how do you respectfully disagree?
Exactly. And at the same time, how do you get your point across in a comedic manner without
especially at
tweaking?
In an age where it seems like only the loud voices are the ones that are heard.
Totally.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So this is for me personally, this is a real struggle, you know? I mean, because I completely recognize within me the desire that so many of us have, which is to shout down the other guy when what the other guy is saying is stupid.
Well,
I get that. Yeah. I get that. And at the same time, you know, again, this question of us as individuals and our individual responsibility to be the change that we want to see, you know, to embody respect. And I don't mean to be, I'm not criticizing Colbert. I'm just asking questions about this, about why it made me uncomfortable. Because in his demeanor, he, of course, was not disrespectful at all. And he is being the change he wants to see. He's actually discussing issues, and he's actually doing it with a sense of humor and a self-deprecating sense of humor.
Absolutely.
So bully for him on all those scores. The second idea that came to mind about why this made me uncomfortable, though, is for me the one that opens a much bigger kind of can of worms.
Uh-oh.
You mentioned before that many people don't know, or didn't know at the time, right, that he really wasn't conservative.
Right.
Clearly, they hadn't been watching the show, or they didn't appreciate the true irony.
Yeah, and they didn't get irony.
Right.
I think
true
that's
irony.
Yeah.
Not the irony of Jimmy Fallon, not the irony of Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, the National Lampoon, of this kind of, I mean, true in the literary sense, irony.
Right.
And people didn't understand that. Well, you know, people around the world view what goes on here, of course.
Of course.
And I feel like none of them would get it.
What?
Would get that it was a joke.
What?
Because they wouldn't know who he was. Yeah.
But the tone, I mean, I'm using my, hopefully this will get on a C-SPAN 1. I mean, how many great lines came out of that thing?
I know, but if you don't know, this is the question that I'm asking you. If you don't know who he is, and no one outside this country knows who he is.
Well, he's shown on CNN worldwide, isn't he?
Look, I mean, I was always shocked when I first started traveling, you know, globally. You know, like nobody knew who Letterman was. I mean, nobody knew who, you know, you think of our, and that's the thing, right, about our comedies, the comedies that do well overseas versus the ones that do not, are people who come from television here, from television comedy, especially from Saturday Night Live. Their movies did not do well internationally because nobody knew who they were.
Right. They didn't have any of that momentum.
Our television sketch comedy does not export well.
No. Well, it barely plays well here.
And so that's what I wonder. I just wonder, you know, what are we...
what are we exporting? You're worried about our foreign policy, our look on that. Well, but that's the other question. How many people are watching congressional hearings worldwide?
You know, though, that's the thing that always surprises me when we travel, is how much more aware of our political system the rest of the world is, versus us being, first of all, not only aware of their political system, but maybe even aware of our political system.
Well, exactly.
I mean, more people in Europe, when we were starting to make Karl Rove, I Love You, more people in Europe knew who Karl Rove was than Americans did.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always the case, which is, you know, why I'm not worried about my immigration, because I have a Canadian education.
But anyway, so it was fascinating, but I love that. At the same time, of course, so as I'm uncomfortable as an individual wrestling with these things, I love that here this guy does something that is getting us, inspiring us to talk about these things.
These things, exactly. Political commentary done through comedy, which is exactly what good comedy does. It actually cuts through the hypocrisy and it just highlights in very simple ways who's the idiot and how the whole system is failing.
Yeah, because, you know, you're going to push boundaries, and sometimes you're going to go too far, and sometimes you're going to step over the line. No matter who you are and what you do, if you're trying to ever deepen your relationship to things, if that your community, be that your fellow man, if you know yourself, if you are someone who is constantly raising the bar for yourself and others, boy, you're going to piss people off.
Yeah,
and that's going to happen. For everyone. And so then the question becomes, there are certain things, though, that you don't ever need to do. Like, you don't ever need to be mean.
Right.
And he isn't.
He wasn't
ever
mean at all.
But you know, there was that a was mean the really yeah. nice trick about it.
It was really incredible that way.
Yeah. And almost, I think that might be why some of the people are so pissed off.
I would think so. There's nothing to fight him against.
Yeah.
Because it's like everything he said was true.
They're so pissed because you can't fight him on, you can't fight him on any emotional level.
Right. There's nothing you could do. You can't.
And that's what makes me mad. Yeah. You know, so I'm going to grab my ball and I'm going to go home.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what they did. How childish is that?
And that brings to mind the, no, you know what? Actually, that brings to mind. You know the how I was saying, though, nobody knows who he is over, like overseas.
Yeah.
There's Lyle sent me this. There is someone who apparently has been listening to the show, but just hates me. Just hates me.
Well, get in line.
And among the things that this person wrote, apparently from this post that Lyle sent me, is about me, I don't know, being a rapist and
what?
And pushing people to suicide. And I'm like going, what is this? And do you remember a couple years ago when MySpace was big and there was the cult of interest surrounding Amy Sedaris?
Yes. And you joined.
Oh, you're right. Again, for people outside the country who don't know, Amy Sedaris is a brilliant comedian. Brilliant.
Hilarious.
Created the show Strangers with Candy. Has had supporting roles in many different
Broadway
movies.
Shows that she's done.
Broadway. She writes plays.
She cooks cupcakes for a little place in the Bowery.
A younger sister of best-selling author David Sedaris. Anyway, a genius.
Yes.
And that word gets thrown around too much. Amy Sedaris is a genius. And anyway, so this cult of celebrity around her and all these fictional characters and storylines evolved on MySpace surrounding in one way or another Amy Sedaris.
Okay.
Well, one of the things was there's this fictional publicist for Amy Sedaris that was created called Jeff Barge, who was a fictional publicist who would then start appearing in different websites, posting things about Amy to publicize her. Okay. Well, Jeff Barge committed suicide.
Oh, hilarious.
Yeah, Jeff Barge is fictional. He committed suicide because he was forced into being outed or something. I kind of lost the plot because it started being like, boy, some people have way too much time on their hands and all this sort of stuff. But so then there was this fictional civil suit. Nobody was apparently charged. But anyway, there was this fictional civil suit that again was publicized through MySpace, and then phony little things showed up on other websites. But about a group of people being sued in the wrongful death, the cyber stalking suicide death of phony publicist, of fictional publicist Jeff Barge.
Okay.
And the people who were named as the people responsible for Jeff Barge's death were Amy Sedaris, Stephen Colbert, Phil Lernis.
What?
Members of the Colbert staff. Unnamed. Just that.
Just
not
that.
Even names. Just members of the Colbert Report staff. Okay, so, it's like, and I barely paid attention to it. A couple people asked me about it at the time, going, what is this about? And I go, I don't know. I don't know who did it. I don't know. And it's just like, but it's so you read it and you go, it's so ridiculous. Nobody's ever going to take this seriously. Among other things, the other people who were named as responsible, superhero Tech Jensen, a comic book superhero,
right,
and a cartoon superhero, and Andy Warhol's wig, also responsible for this person's death.
Wow.
So this is 2 years ago or whatever. Anyway, but this is to just underscore what I'm saying. This person who listens to our show, who doesn't like me, found this and thought it was real.
I thought you drove this person who
thinks me and a cartoon superhero and a wig that was worn by Andy Warhol,
who is real,
and Amy Sedaris and Stephen Colbert, that all these that this was real, that we drove this person to suicide, a fictional person to suicide, and got away with it. And the thing is that we live in kind of scary times, because if you have a feeling about someone or something that is, let's say, negative, or you don't like that, you can find, as we've talked about before, about anything on the web,
right,
you can find something that justifies your point of view.
Absolutely.
And God bless anybody. If they hate me, they hate me. Whatever. Other people are going to hate me. It's going to be fine. The thing I actually... When he sent me this, I felt so bad for this person because they didn't... Well, I mean, it's possible that this person actually authored the fictional thing, and that this whole thing that Lyle found is just a joke anyway. So that's possible. That's why this is being brought back now, is that the person authored this.
Right.
But the larger thing, and this is what the Stephen Colbert thing reminded me, is that it's also possible to come to something and go, aha, and not know that it's all just fictional.
Which, yeah, is just like the Joaquin Phoenix documentary, right? That the whole thing was played for real, and then when they finally released it and box office wasn't that great, they come out and apologize, going, oh, no, it was just a character, even though they were clearly going out of their way to make it as real as possible, to tell as few people that who knew. I'm talking about Casey Affleck,
right,
and Joaquin
right.
Phoenix and what is even I'm Not Here, the documentary. And so this is interesting, because these are the same issues in contemporary art. Who won the Venice Biennial last year, or this year even, was the German artist who just moved his apartment into the art gallery and just lived there for a month. And that, it was just his apartment as he lived there in the art gallery. That was the piece. He didn't change anything about his apartment. It was all the actual items from his apartment in the art gallery. And this won the Best in Show, because this idea now of breaking down what is fictional, what is real, what is art, hyperrealism, all of these avenues are now intersecting in such a way that it's become almost a full circle, a snake eating its own tail.
Well, what's interesting about them making this apology of, it was fake. The whole thing was fake. is that I think they stung. I think they felt the sting of people absolutely rejecting it.
Yeah.
And here's something interesting. When people write or say things about you, you know, I to a degree, it's not always it's not exactly like reviews. But we've talked before about how personal reviews get now. And again, how mean our culture has become with instant crack judgment without analysis. It's just everybody's mean.
Right.
And
because that gets ratings and filthy critic is number
one. You know, and the more funny or sarcastic I can be in being mean, the more right I am.
Right.
And because I don't give you room or invite you to disagree with me, because then you're just as much of an idiot as the person I'm criticizing.
Absolutely.
Right? So, but you know, the thing that David Lynch once said, your favorite, but that's what's great about this, is that people that you, again, you don't like or you don't agree with are every bit as capable of coming up with something really insightful.
Absolutely.
And you know, and he said that it's never criticism leveled against something you believe in that hurts you. It's when people criticize the stuff that you deep down didn't believe in. Like, you know, as I've heard before, that anything anybody says about you really only can affect you if some part of you thinks there's truth in it.
Right, because then you can glom on.
You never get pissed off about things other people say if there isn't part of you attached to what they're saying.
Right.
And so... You know,
which then goes back to Congress and why they were all pissed off.
Right, exactly. Right? And so I thought that was, you know, really brilliant. And Lynch was pointing this out because I think he was talking about the reviews of Lost Highway and how that was rejected. But he knew he made the movie he wanted to make. The criticism of Dune killed him because he didn't believe in the movie.
Right, yeah. And I was one of those who was... killing that movie.
So, you know, I hear that, you know, somebody's criticizing me because I drove a fictional publicist to death. You know, it's like, how am I supposed to be upset about that? You know, it's like I'd have to think that that was somehow real in order to be upset about it. And so that's kind of the thing.
It's interesting.
And with Casey Affleck and these guys, which is why I bring this up. There has to be part of them that was unsure about what they were doing in the first place.
Right. It seemed like a thing
to apologize.
To apologize. And apologize 2 weeks after the box office comes out, too. It reminds me of...
It makes it seem like they thought, oh, well, I'm not sure if this is a... Oh, but it'll make money.
Right. Well, I also think that it's like some stand-up comics I know, that when they get really good at their craft... they'll go on stage and actually purposely tank their show in the middle to see if they have the ability to get the audience back by the end of the show.
Right.
So they'll actually go out of the way and they'll either have someone removed from the show, a heckler, like stop the show, or they'll like, you know, just to see how much control they can have over an audience.
Well, let's face it. You've had to, not had to, you've just done it, well, for your own reasons. I'm not even going to put ideas in your mind. But sometimes I know that you have apologized to people for things that I have said on this show, right? And you're always pointing out to them to kind of listen all the way through.
Right.
Because, as you know, sometimes I say things that I'm saying simply to provoke.
Right,
because
you're a dick, like I say often.
But you don't say that to people in private, really. No. You tend to say that, you know... Phil always has some kind of a point that he's getting to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And I do find it most interesting that you try to hit different perspectives along the way.
Yeah. That's what you want, for crying out loud. Different perspectives. That's, you know, the duality of our 21st century thinking.
And is that why? Now, the Screen Actors Guild elections, I don't want to delve into this too much, but they took place. The way that I told you I was voting was the winning way. I win, you lose, in your face. I want to ask you
who won. I didn't even follow them.
Well, the moderates.
Oh, the moderates
cleaned up, largely represented by Unite for Strength.
United for Strength
versus Membership First.
Okay.
Biggest news was that the man who was president of the Screen Actors Guild up until a couple years ago, Alan Rosenberg.
Jim Rosenberg.
Actually is no longer even a board member. He lost his seat. That's my, how the mighty have fallen. You know, one of those things. But this is my question. The moderates won. Not a surprise to me at all that, you know, you can't have vitriol being screamed to have any kind of united front.
Right.
If there is going to be a merger of any kind, you know, it has to be discussed
level
calmly.
Yes.
All right. My question is this now, because this does reflect the world at large, and it's just a microcosm of politics everywhere.
Right.
The moderates win this election. They get 75% of the votes, apparently, wow, in this election in the Hollywood division,
wow,
which was almost unheard of because traditionally the moderates took the national board, but the, you know, Unite membership first was far more dominant in Hollywood, and now that's even shifting. My question is, does moderate, do you think that moderate provides for a wider spectrum and more diverse points of view, or not? I mean, this is really my question. You know,
because you're saying I've shaved off the harsh edges so that my range of perspective is gone, and I'm just stuck in a sort of middle tone, yeah, moderate,
yeah,
thing. Even though Aristotle said all things moderation, this is perhaps a weakening of a range of views. Whereas by having in the society we live in now, different points of view only can get across through sheer screaming and fighting and anything forward.
The people that argue that the left-right paradigm is false,
yeah,
politically, your friend Alex Jones talks about this. Many, mm-hmm, people we've encountered talk about this. I rarely talk about these things on the show, but I've always fundamentally believed that that's just ridiculous. That the left-right paradigm is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that we have a whole system that encodes that paradigm as if anyone you ever meet is all this or all that. And yes, there are some people, but they're very rare. Most of us blend our belief system. Some of us are very liberal. Let's say liberal and not progressive. Some of us are very liberal in our thinking, in our actions, and at the same time, very conservative in certain ways.
Right.
What do we conserve? Because we all breathe in and we all breathe out. We contract and expand. All of us. So, you know, this what you see from the political parties, and this is why I get the Tea Party movement, much like I got the hyper hopeful exuberance towards Obama,
right,
by people who'd never been a part of the system before, going out and being the army of hope and change.
Right.
And, you know, what I see is just another... John Stewart said, you know, instead of getting a visionary, we got a functionary. And you know, there are many theories about what Obama is, but that's been from the very beginning, from the election... You know, what I was really concerned by, because people were projecting all over him,
yeah,
whatever they wanted to see. And the truth was, we weren't getting someone with much of a track record, and we were getting someone who was establishment.
Yeah.
You know, you don't become president by not being establishment.
It's true.
And so you saw the Democrats, the quote-unquote liberals and progressives, using that youthful enthusiasm. And when I say youthful enthusiasm, I don't mean just young people,
no,
because people of all ages can have youthful enthusiasm and passion and idealism. And they used those people,
yeah,
to get into power so that they could try to rule from the middle.
Right.
The Tea Party movement is very much expressing an anger of that type, of being used. The way they have taken Karl Rove behind the woodshed and, mm-hmm, said, you know, you used the true conservative movement in this country,
right,
to be able to basically rule as functionaries from the middle.
Hmm.
And they're expressing anger over that.
And you know who was that visionary? Was Ron Paul. There's a guy who...
I'm just checking time. We're fine.
Are we fine?
But so yeah, my question with SAG...
Oh, yeah, sorry.
With SAG, then, is what do you think? Does this eliminate... And the reason that that's dangerous is because... Again, somebody who's on an extreme,
you're right,
may be wrong more often than someone who's in the middle. In fact, probably is wrong more than someone in the middle, because you know, it's like the broken clock. You know, if you're in the middle, if we can say that's a broken clock, at least you're right twice a day.
Right, exactly.
Because you're not taking much of a chance.
Right.
Anybody who's trying to push things forward in a new direction is apt to be wrong more often than they're right.
Absolutely, but SAG
and though actor, they're going to come up with really brilliant ideas.
Right. However,
is there room for those voices?
Not in this go around. I think that there's for the ability of SAG and actor first to merge and then to renegotiate the contract in this landscape. In this new digital media age, that we can't have radical voices undermining the process that has to go forward. It seems so monumental right now that we just have to sort of rein it into a moderate, albeit gray, beige, unfortunately. But it's the through line across the bridge.
To redo the infrastructure.
To redo the infrastructure, to get across, to then bring those voices back. And have those radical new ideas once we've crossed over this.
Okay, so then as a microcosm, is national or global politics any different?
Well, no.
Look where you went. Hey, Blockbuster filed bankruptcy.
Oh, hey, there you go. That's good news. What? Blockbuster files Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That means nobody. That means we're all on Netflix.
No. It means that they'll still be able to operate 3,000 stores. They refiled so that they can stay in business because that's how we play the game.
Right.
Declare bankruptcy so that you can stay in business.
Right.
You've been working for MGM for decades.
You don't have to pay your creditors.
But meanwhile, Netflix has already been declared the winner in the next wave in streaming. Video from content from the web to your television.
Right.
Netflix has already been declared the winner, and now Amazon is starting to jump into it. Like that.
But okay, but still, Netflix doesn't show Karl Rove I Love You anymore, does it?
No, I mean, isn't that the end? And it would seem with every move that's being made, especially with streaming, well, that takes up no space at all. You know,
right.
It's like,
so they're removing the independent voices out there.
Or certain independent voices for certain reasons. Who knows? I mean, that would be the interesting thing to look at.
And you never did get an explanation where that
I've got plenty of explanations, but none of them are... All we've been able to verify is that the explanations aren't true.
Right.
So we don't know what the explanations are, right? So...
And you're not a conspiracy theorist.
Well, no, because I don't have a theory.
Oh.
I'm not connecting the dots to come up with something.
You don't think
I have no control over it. Nor am I motivated to try to feel like I have control over it by concocting a theory.
So you don't think a hilarious comedy of anti, and possibly, you know, it's the same sort of thing, just like Colbert and just like Dan
Could
Butler.
Karl Rove, maybe Karl Rove's friends with one of the chief investors at Netflix. Who knows?
That's what I'm saying.
Who knows? And to a certain degree, why does it matter?
Because your movie's not being seen, but people should see it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I got other things to do.
Oh, okay.
I got a lot of responsibilities.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
We got another movie to go.
Hell, we've got questions to answer on
Let's answer.
On this week's show. There's so much. First of all, quick show business news. You know, Mel Gibson has had a little bit of problems.
A little bit. Yeah.
And yet there's talk that his performance in Jodie Foster's film, Jodie Foster directed a new film, an independent film called The Beaver, and that Mel Gibson is nothing short of incredible in it, just amazing. And there's a lot of Oscar talk about his, his performance.
I want to see that Oscar speech.
Could he get nominated, do you think, given the what's
the
gone
climate?
On? The real question is whether or not it gets distributed. Summit owns the rights to it, but it doesn't have a release date yet.
Huh. Oh, it's got to be.
I mean, if you owned the distribution rights to it, given what's been going on with Mel Gibson, do you release it this year? Or do you wait a year and hope that... I will go first. I would say I don't think... I think you always have to expect the horse to continue riding in the direction it's going.
Yeah.
There is no reason to believe a year from now
he's going
to
do anything.
Things won't be
worse.
I think the way to make things better is now release a really great work.
Yeah.
And
that's what I'd say. Also, I'd say, you know, this in terms of branding, brand awareness on Mel Gibson, bad or good, there's brand awareness. And right. so that sells a movie.
When Woody Allen started dating his daughter.
Yes.
The film that came out at that time, during the big tabloid breakup with Mia Farrow and when all those horrible details were coming out, Hannah was Husbands and Wives.
Husbands and Wives, right.
You know, one of his only really great films of the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Post-90, you know, post-Crimes and Misdemeanors, one of his only truly great films. And so, of course, it got great reviews, got lots of Oscar nominations, and even the ones that wanted to criticize Woody Allen all said, it's a shame nobody sat Woody Allen down to watch Husbands and Wives. And there was a degree to which that timing was perfect because the film could withstand what was going on. And if this is that good, it makes me think that, especially from what I've read about the performance, it's like, well, yeah, you know, Mel Gibson is stark raving insane. And
he can channel it into a movie.
And he can channel it. And sometimes we need insanity because look at the art that comes out of it.
Right.
Not that that justifies the behavior. It's that there's always something right about it.
Though. Right, exactly.
You know, that this is the...
The madness that runs the boat. Wow.
I'll tell you, a film a year from now that we may be talking about, again, from someone who's had their own share of unpleasantness.
Uh-huh.
Our old friend Roman Polanski.
Oh,
you know, speaking of rapists, it's the show all about rapists and bad behavior.
I want to see you blog that.
Yeah, Roman Polanski. You know, his hard time is done. You know that the hard time he had to do in his Swiss chalet
with the anklet.
Anyway, he's about to go into production on an adaptation of the Broadway winning the Tony winning play, Yasmina Risa's God of Carnage, a play that I really wanted to see that's finally coming to Los Angeles in the first quarter of 2011.
That's right.
Anyway, the big screen adaptation of it's being made. Polanski's directing, which seems like a good fit artistically.
Yes.
And anyway, and the cast includes Christoph Waltz, Oscar winner for Inglourious Bastards. How about this female tandem? Polanski's directing Jodie Foster and Kate Winslet.
What?
They're playing the female leads.
Wow. And
so a year from now, we could be very well talking about Polanski getting more accolades.
Well, you know, as you said, he's a good director regardless of whatever his personal habits are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I am an advocate for don't kill the work of art because of him.
Right.
You know, and I get it. I get the anger that people have, and I get the idea that you're rewarding him, that somehow he's being rewarded for what happened. And I just know that if you killed the work of art, then we're the ones that suffer.
Yeah,
fundamentally, right. We're the ones that suffer, not the artist. If it's good.
Right.
If it's good.
Huh. Well, there you go. Letters, email.
We
got to get through them. Seconds remain.
Boy, yeah, we've got so much to talk about. Okay, Terrence, I'm going to get the name wrong. Terrence Tarek, I'm pronouncing it, from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, yes.
Who was turned on to Chilpak Hollywood Hour through your appearance on the Comedy Film Nerds podcast.
Oh.
And he particularly appreciated our episode where we discussed 9/11
recently. Excellent.
Anyway, he sent us an email question. He was listening to us talking about, you know, films that are mismarketed and misleading, and he really took me especially to task for saying that Never Let Me Go is misleading or mismarketed. He's a big fan of the novel.
Uh-huh.
He said that when you said that it looked like sort of Remains of the Day, that you nailed it on the head. You hit the nail on the head because it's written by the author who wrote Remains of the Day.
Right.
Okay. He said that it's very well marketed because it really captures the book, the trailer. And I've heard this now from other people who have read the book, that the trailer works.
Oh.
I still would like to get back to the point, though. Do you have any idea what it's about?
No.
No, and we haven't read the book.
Right.
And so if it only is getting it right for people who have read the book, I again would say it's being mismarketed.
Right, because you're trying to then find a new audience as
opposed
to... And
maybe all we're capturing is the tone of it, but this gets back to the conversation we once had before, which is you really can't market tone, unfortunately.
Right.
Unfortunately, but that's different... That's different.
All over the place. And tone is so important in a movie.
Tone is... Art is all about tone.
Right.
Marketing is not about art.
Right. Two different things.
So that's difficult. But the other thing that I wanted to bring up, and I loved his note, and it's... He said it's a huge stretch to classify the film and the novel as a sci-fi thriller. Oh. Even though the people I know who've seen it say that it's a sci-fi thriller. I haven't seen it.
Right.
So I can't agree or disagree to whether it being a sci-fi thriller. I can only report what I've been told. What I would like to point out, though, is, and I'm guessing that Terrence is a sci-fi fan.
Okay.
He was also, I think, a big X-Files fan.
Awesome.
And but he says that it's not fair to call it science fiction because science fiction brings to mind things like spaceships and lasers and it's only science fiction in the way that The Handmaid's Tale, Gattaca, Children of Men, Clockwork Orange, and the works of Philip K. Dick are science fiction. It's only science fiction in the way that those are. In other words. It's science fiction.
well,
because this is one of my big things, and I'm passionate about this.
Yes, you are.
Do not let we who love science fiction, and we love it because it includes all those works, and yes, includes alien spaceships and lasers.
Right, right.
That it includes comedy, that includes thriller, that it includes horror, that it includes time travel, that it is a way to deal with all the most resonant themes of the human condition and portray them in so many ways that by bringing people away from their here and now, they are somehow brought closer to truths about their here and now. Those of us that love science fiction, we cannot allow science fiction to be defined by people who don't like science fiction, who look down upon it.
Yeah.
And that's simply a microcosm. Anything that you believe in and that you care about and that you are passionate about, don't let people who hate it or who don't understand it define it for you.
Right. And this is what I think. Chris Carter, who wrote The X-Files, said specifically that he didn't think... And this was the battle. He didn't want The X-Files to be relegated under science fiction... the genre, because he thought that exactly the same thing. It's defined as, you know, guys on the holodecks in Lycra suits flying around space. And so he coined a term. I said, so what do you think it is? And he said, it's science probability. And I would think that this and Clockwork Orange and all of these sort of things are projecting a future like Philip K. Dick did, that if you've run what has currently gone on in our society in the same direction into the future, then you have a statistical probability of what that future would look like. And that's the story you tell. And so, yes, there's science involved because you're determining how future technologies and things are going to come together. But you're doing it from a probability point of view that this may or may not happen. And, of course, you know, some of it's come true and some of it hasn't. But these things are put under Chris Carter's pseudo term of science probability.
And I think he got himself into trouble by kind of saying that, by trying to distance himself. Again, if you're worried about what those people are saying and how they're defining you, you're already getting defensive about it.
Right. Then there's something deep inside it that you believe.
Exactly.
Right.
Don't defend it. Say this works. And here's why it works.
Exactly.
So Terrence, thank you for the email and thank you for listening. We will save a great email from Ket Majmudar, I'm going to say is the pronunciation. Please forgive me, Ket, if I've blown it. But Ket discovered us by attending a panel at Sci-Fi London that we were on. And anyway, he sent a great email that's in both our wheelhouses, and we promise to answer it next week.
Why don't we start with that next week?
A few quick announcements before we go. And all of these emails come to us at our email address, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Whether you listen to us at our official website, chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com, where you can download and stream every episode we've ever done and even subscribe via iTunes. Whether you listen to us, the most recent show on MySpace.
At
myspace.com/chillpackhollywood. That's MySpace, where I once was responsible for the suicide death of a fictional publicist.
I don't know how that
Whether you listen to us there, or whether you listen to us on Jackalope Radio. We love Jackalope.
We love Jackalope.
Where we're on twice a week.
Yep.
Please write us. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, and we love hearing from everybody.
Absolutely.
We have a couple of announcements to make. Our very good friend, who was very sweet and very generous to us and gave us so much of his time and told wonderful stories for our film, Reg Presley.
Oh, yes.
Lead singer of the Troggs.
The Troggs,
author of Wild Things They Don't Tell Us, about so many mysteries.
Right.
Just a real explorer.
Not just crop circles.
And what a great man, great storyteller.
Had a great time.
He had a stroke a few weeks ago.
That.
He's recovering apparently nicely in Spain.
Oh, good.
With his wife, and we send our love and best wishes
yes.
to him. We throw out happy 46th birthday to our very own Pete Handelman.
What?
A guest on, I think, Chillpack Hollywood Hour number 40.
Wow. That's so going back.
I don't know if he wants me to say that he's 46, but I just did.
Wow. You
But 46 is the new, like, 45.
32.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
I start counting backwards right about from here.
Well, now that you're going to become an American.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you have to prove you're from our education system. Also, happy birthday to loyal Chillpack Hollywood Hour listener and future Chillpack Hollywood Hour guest. We've talked about having him on before. We're going to do it. World famous, world class storyboard artist, Robbie Consing.
Oh, yeah.
And
I'm actually want him on the show soon because I'm interested in storyboarding.
Great. So we'll make sure we lock that down soon. You know, for his birthday, I gave him this really, we're not going to talk about what we're reading, but I gave him this great book of walking in ice, Munich to Paris. And it's the journal, the daily journal that Werner Herzog, wild, crazy Werner Herzog, kept in 1974 when he walked in the winter from Munich to Paris.
Just along the roads and stuff?
And it's his daily journal. And it's like a journal that most of us would keep, only he's talking about, instead of mislaying his car keys, how he mislaid the compass that he got from, like, a tribesman in Africa. You know, that was gifted to him. So, anyway, it's a really cool book. I don't know why I wanted to share that, but that's
hilarious.
Any other announcements? I think we pretty much...
I'm going to be at the premiere of Atlantis Down in Portsmouth, Virginia. The tickets are already sold out, but I will tell you all about that.
When's that?
I'm flying out on Thursday, and it'll be on Friday night. It'll be very exciting. A big red carpet premiere at a theater in Portsmouth, Virginia. A movie I did called Atlantis Down.
Wow, I can't wait to hear about that. Yeah. I'll be editing.
Yes, you will. And snap it up, pal, because I'll be drinking it up in Virginia.
I'm Phil Ernest.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you next week.